Jez Nelson on Jazz on 3 for our Warsaw special tomorrow night at 11 p.m. here on BBC Radio 3.
The time now is midday, time on Radio 3 for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Margaret Mountford hails from Northern Ireland. She's a successful businesswoman and lawyer, but is probably best known to you as an extremely perceptive and wise member of Alan Sugar's team of experts on The Apprentice. In fact, Margaret, you recently left that to continue your studies.
That's right. I think it must be about 2 years ago now when I thought that if I was ever going to finish my PhD, I'd better get a move on. So I said goodbye to The Apprentice.
What is the PhD on?
Well, I'm studying Greek documentary papyri, which basically is documents written in classical Greek, found in Egypt, preserved by the dry climate, so found in desert areas, mostly found on rubbish tips. And because they were found on rubbish tips, they could be anything. It's anything people have thrown away. So you get books, obviously, and literary papyri as well, but I'm concentrating on documents. So all sorts of documents, letters, contracts, tax returns.
Was this something you've been wanting to do for a long time during, or were you continuing to do it even to a certain extent during your business activities?
No, I wasn't. I'd done some classics at school. I'd done some Latin and some Greek. And I was always interested in visiting classical sites on holidays. And after about 25 years in the city, I thought I'd been a lawyer for long enough and thought, well, it's time to do something else. What shall I do? And I toyed with various ideas. And I thought, well, I'll go back and study classics because I really enjoyed classics before. And that led on to papyrology and led on to the PhD, which hopefully I'll finish in December.
So you're not to be seen on Greek rubbish tips then, rifling through...
No, thankfully, a couple of famous scholars, Grenfell and Hunt, spent a lot of time rifling through rubbish tips about 100 years ago.
When there was something to find.
Yeah. Well, there still is plenty to find, although obviously it's more difficult. But there are many, many documents which haven't been edited yet, and so there's a huge source of raw material.
Quite a lot of IOU notes in Greece at the moment, I dare say.
Yes, well, nothing changes, does it?
When you joined The Apprentice, it wasn't a sort of manufactured liaison, because you had actually worked with Alan Sugar for a long time.
Yes, he was one of my clients. I was a solicitor in one of the big city firms, and we acted on the flotation of Amstrad, which was his electronics company, and I think it was 1980, and that was the first time I'd come across him. And then I acted on most of his corporate and commercial work until I retired in 1999. So we'd done a lot of deals together over the years.
Were you surprised that the thing took off to quite the extent it has?
Yes, completely. I mean, I hardly ever watch television. I'm completely a non-media sort of person. When we did the first series, nobody really knew whether it was going to be very popular, how long it would run for, and I went into it because I thought, well, it'll be interesting, it'll be different. It's not something I could have done as a partner in a major city firm. Let's give it a go and see what it's like and see what the television world is like, because I knew nothing about it at all.
I think it came at a moment when the BBC were quite keen to try and show that they could do something for science, something for business, and actually expand those areas of their output. I mean, I wonder whether you think it has actually done anything.
I think The Apprentice has interested a lot of young people in business and made them think of careers in business when they wouldn't otherwise have done so. And that not just children who leave school perhaps without higher education, but also a lot of bright kids who would have thought of automatically going into a profession and actually thought, well, maybe there's something to this business lark, which is a good idea because we can't have everybody being professionals.
When you're not watching television, which, as you say, is most of the time, you are to be found in a concert hall or an opera house, I think, by choice.
Probably an opera house, first choice, and a concert hall, second choice, but they're pretty close, yes.
And in fact, the first music you've got is actually from a concert at the Wigmore Hall, one actually that I was at, strangely enough, a rather wonderful pianist who died a few years ago.
Yes, it's a Hungarian Rhapsody played by Shura Cherkassky, who was the most wonderful pianist, and I went to many concerts of his. And as you all know, when he came on the stage, he looked so self-effacing and humble and modest and quiet, and then he'd sit down at the piano stool and play the most amazing music and then stand up and give a very neat little bow at the end, almost as if he was embarrassed to be there.
What do you like about this particular piece?
I love this piece. It's very tuneful. It's very melodic. It's got a fantastic amount of virtuoso playing in it. And he brings it off fantastically well, I think.
Thank you. it's so wonderful to have a memory of somebody where his sense of humour comes across so brilliantly.
Mm.
And actually, it could not do so without a fantastic technique.
Yes, and I think when you see him play, you realise just how where the hands are going and how technically difficult it is. But he was amazing, and he always had a little quirk or a smile and a little light top note.
We heard Shura Czerkassky playing the Hungarian Rhapsody No. 2 in C-sharp minor by Liszt, and that was a recording made in 1993 at the Wigmore Hall. And indeed, that's another great pianist now, George Bellet. Fascinating to hear these Schubert transcriptions by Liszt. Liszt is obviously rather important to you.
Yes, I love Liszt's music, and I think it's amazing what he does to a beautiful Schubert song and how he transcends it and transforms it. I mean, this is a beautiful lead to listen to, sung, but this takes it to another dimension, I think.
And of course, it's a very famous song.
Very, very famous song.
Die Forelle, the Trout.
Mm. There's a wonderful CD of Schubert song transcriptions with Bollett playing. And Bollett was another fantastic pianist. Very different stature from Czerkassky and a different approach to the piano and huge hands, I think. Yeah. But wonderful lightness of touch.
Well, Czerkassky looked like an artist, but Bollett actually, funny enough, looked as though he might be somebody who came from your world of business, didn't he? Do you know what I mean? It's like
yes.
Neat moustache and...
Neat moustache and...
Officer's poise.
Officer's poise, yes. Bank manager, perhaps.
Thank you.
Di Forella, The Trout, by Schubert, transcribed for the piano by Liszt. George Bolette was the pianist. Well, clearly you wanted to now have Schubert with the voice, having we've heard Schubert as transcribed by Liszt. Now we're going to have the real thing.
Yes, Schubert as he is wrote, I suppose one could put it like that, because we're moving on to a Schubert lead in its original form. And I chose this one in particular. I remember studying Goethe's poetry at school for A-level, and this is a very simple poem, and I think it's a fantastic example of how the music enhances the words. Sometimes the setting isn't quite so felicitous, perhaps, but in this case, I think it just goes perfectly together, and Fischer-Dieskau has such a magnificent voice. He can sing anything, can't he? Well, you couldn't not rest after that, could you? I mean, it's perfect.
Such marvellous control of the voice.
Wonderful. And no breathing that you can hear. Fantastic.
And the ability to float notes. Mm. Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau singing Wanderes Nachtlied No. 2 by Schubert, with Jörg Demus playing the piano. Our next composer is one of those figures who is slightly pushed to one side, simply because of the prominence, in fact, of Liszt. But a lot of people feel undeservedly so.
Well, I think it's largely due to Ronald Smith that people in this country, other than the cognoscenti, whom I don't include myself as one, know about Alcan at all. And I went to lots of concerts with Ronald Smith in the 80s and 90s. And once you listen to Alcan, you can't really understand why he isn't more popular and better known, because his music is very accessible. It's wonderful to listen to, and it's very much of its time. And, you know, why Liszt is so much better known and more popular, I don't know.
Alcan was very disappointed himself, because when he was 14 and was already prodigiously gifted and given concerts, he met Liszt, who was 2 years his senior. And I think he thought at that point that his career was taking off in much the same sort of direction. And then it just sort of, his popularity petered out, and he became rather reclusive later in life.
Yes, he had a rather sad death, didn't he? He was killed by a getting a book out of a bookcase.
Well, it's alleged that his bookcase fell on him. That's the kind of thing you get in a musical quiz. But I think it's disputed by scholars now that it's a nice idea, but I fear he may have escaped the bookcase and just died a natural death in the final analysis. But this is Song of the Mad Woman on the Seashore. And what attracts you to this in particular?
Well, I think it's haunting. And I heard him play it a few times, including at one of the most wonderful recitals I was ever at, his 80th birthday recital, where he played this amazing programme. And he played three Alcan pieces at the end, of which this was one. And apart from wanting to murder the woman sitting two rows behind, whose mobile phone went off during it, it was an absolutely perfect concert.
Ronald Smith played Song of the Mad Woman on the Seashore from the Preludes Opus 31 by Alcar. I've still not quite got to the bottom of his demise. Various stories about what actually fell on him. Which brings us, Margaret Mountford, rather appropriately, I suppose, to the announcement of death from Die Walküre, because, as you said earlier, opera is your other great passion, apart from the piano.
Yes, it is, and I'm very lucky to have a friend who works in Covent Garden who takes me into some rehearsals sometimes, and they have to sort of prize me out of the building at the end. But I wasn't an opera fan early on. I particularly wasn't a Wagner fan until I heard The Good All Ring at the ENO in the mid-70s, and I was completely blown away by it. It was the most magnificent experience. It was, you know, one went for four nights in within 8 days, I think it was, and it had a wonderful cast of singers with Norman Bailey and Rita Hunter and Alberto Remedios and Goodall conducting. It was most fantastic. And I remember at the end of Goethe Dämmerung, it must have been some sort of anniversary of Rita Hunter's performing at the Colosseum, because they handed her, as a token, the breastplate that she'd worn as Brunhilde, and she'd just done this, you know, amazing death scene, and there'd been the fire and everything. And she turned to the audience and she held up this massive piece of armour and she just said, "Caught, hadn't she got big boobs?" And everybody just fell about her.
The thing about Wagner is that you either really adore it, or quite often you rather hate it. But there is sometimes a sort of Damascene moment for people, isn't there? And then couldn't do without it almost.
Yes, I think it's insidious like that. And this announcement of death from Act Two of Walküre is my favourite part of the entire Ring cycle. I'm not quite sure why. I think it's the contrast between what's gone before and what comes immediately afterwards. And there's this wonderfully still period, and the way the music builds up, she's asking him questions, he's saying, "No, I don't want to go to Valhalla." And I know probably purists and people who know more about Wagner would say, "Oh, it's a terribly important pivotal part in the whole drama, as the whole plan is sort of unravelling before Wotan's eyes." But I'm afraid I take all that with a bit of a pinch of salt, really, and I just enjoy the music.
Thank you.
The Announcement of Death from Die Walküre, Act 2 by Wagner. Rita Hunter sang Brunhilde, and Alberto Remedios, absolutely wonderful voice there, sang Siegmund with the English National Opera Orchestra, conducted by Reginald Goodall. Conductors and pianists seem to reach quite ripe old ages. Well, actually, I'm saying hopefully composers do.
Well, they do. They say that music is one of the things that keeps your brain active. I don't know whether that's true. I hope listening achieves the same effect. But certainly we're coming on to a piece by Vlado Perlmutter, and I think it was recorded when he was 79. But certainly he went on playing in recitals in London. I heard him in his 70s. And a fantastic pianist. And there does seem to be something about just they sit down in front of the piano and the years fall off. I remember going to Louis Kentner's 80th birthday recital many, many years ago. And you'd have thought it was a young man at the piano.
This is the Chopin Nocturne in F-sharp major, opus 15, number 2. And having talked about piano music and composers like Alcan and Liszt, I suppose Chopin is quite a natural member of the piano composer, since, I mean, he almost exclusively wrote for the piano.
Yes, and I think, I mean, this is called Private Passions, isn't it? And, you know, if I see there's a piano recital coming, I look and see what the programme is, and if it's Liszt or Schubert or Chopin or, rarely, Alcan, I'll be there.
And this piece in particular means what to you?
Well, I love the nocturnes. I think, again, that they're an example of how you can have what sounds deceptively simple, and it may not be full of wonderful piano athleticism like the Liszt, for example, but the feeling that comes over just from a few notes put together by a master. Wonderful.
Thank you.
But there's a bittersweet quality to the nocturnes, isn't there?
There is, to most of Chopin's music, I think. And there's whether it's a sort of Polish longing for something, I don't know, there's a sadness to it.
Yeah, and even there, for example, he'll give you a little fragment of tune, and then it comes, but just moved up two or three notes. And that has the effect of sort of twisting the knife.
Mm.
Vlado Perlmutter played the Nocturne in F-sharp major, Opus 15, number 2, by Chopin. More Wagner.
Yes, more Wagner, but Tannhäuser this time. There was a new production of Tannhäuser at the Royal Opera House this year with Christian Gerhaar singing this part, and it was just amazing. And when at this particular part, Elizabeth just disappears. She just walked to the back of the stage and disappeared into the mist. And she'd gone. Died isn't quite the right term, I suppose. She'd moved on. And passed over, that's it. She'd passed over. And then you get this wonderful, wonderful song.
And we haven't got Christian Gerhaar, but we have got Thomas Hampson, who's a pretty good substitute.
Oh, Thomas Hampson's got a wonderful voice. Even makes me like listening to American songs.
Schwebt im Tal ihr
That was another wonderful example, wasn't it, of lines that were really grateful to sing.
Absolutely. And his diction is so fantastic. It's a wonderful, smooth tone. The diction is so clear.
We heard Wie Todesahnung and then O du mein holder Abendstern from Tannhäuser Act 3, Scene 2. Wolfram von Eschenbach was sung by Thomas Hampson with the Berlin Staatskapelle, conducted by Daniel Barenboim. We move from Wagner to Verdi, another passion. So you do encompass quite a large part of the operatic compass, Margaret Mumford.
Well, perhaps, but there probably isn't much between them in terms of things that I enjoy listening to. But no, Verdi and Wagner are my two favourite operatic composers. And I had to have something that was sung by Pavarotti, who had the most amazing voice. Just this sound seemed to come effortlessly, right on the note. No, you were never aware that maybe it was an effort to get there. The voice just came out and hit it bang on. And so he was a very relaxing tenor to listen to, as well as a very inspiring and exhilarating one.
And here you get two for the price of one great singers.
Absolutely, because you get Dame Joan as well. And, you know, the two voices together, I never heard them singing live together. I wish I had, because obviously their voices just went so well together, and they must have had this great stage relationship with one another that they just worked terribly well together.
This is the Brindisi from Act One of La Traviata. Just describe what's happening here.
Well, there's a party at Violetta's house, and Alfredo comes in and he's introduced to her and he's smitten. She's his beautiful courtesan, and her then boyfriend refuses to sing, and Alfredo says, OK, I'll sing this drinking song. And then they have this wonderfully joyful, unlike probably most of the pieces that there have been today, a wonderfully joyful song together.
Thank you.
two great artists. And you could just tell, even with the way they were using one or two inflections. You and I both looked at each other at a certain moment in one of the Pavarotti phrases, and he was just stretching a note. You mentioned that this was a happy song, but of course the denouement of Traviata is anything but. And I was wondering whether you would like to address your perspicacity to the fact that we like sad music, that we want to be moved, we want to be disturbed slightly.
Maybe it's an easy way of being disturbed slightly without one's own emotions really being involved. I don't find it sad, actually. I've always found Leonard Cohen cheerful, so I don't know whether I have a different approach to music. But I think uplifting, and whether it's uplifting because it takes you out of yourself. I mean, you cannot, well, I can't anyway, do anything else other than listen to those pieces. You can't work and have them on in the background. That just doesn't work. And so just having to concentrate on something like that, which is performed by people who are absolute masters of what they're doing, is uplifting.
We heard Joan Sutherland as Violetta, Luciano Pavarotti as Alfredo, with the National Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Richard Bonning, in the Brindisi from La Traviata, Act 1, by Verdi. A lovely note on which to finish. So, Margaret Mountford, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Margaret Mountford was talking to Michael Barclay. Next week at the same time, Michael's guest on Private Passions will be the photographer, writer and television presenter Lucinda Lambton. Private Passions is a classic arts production for Radio 3, and the producer of today's programme was Chris Marshall. Well, there's more music by Wagner in our Sunday concert at 2 o'clock, a concert given by the Budapest Festival Orchestra, conducted by Ivan Fischer. And their programme will include Siegfried Idle, the overture and bacchanal from Tannhäuser, and Brunhilde's immolation scene from Götterdämmerung, sung by Eva Johansson. That's our Sunday concert, which starts today at 2 o'clock. That's here on BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. Now, here's some information about Drama on 3 this evening.
I would give anything. Anything.
Through unimaginable challenge, an unwavering belief.
A vision!
Follow him!
Hooray!
New writing.
The death penalty is a self-defensive right of the state.
And classic drama.
Christ in heaven. She did come from God.
On BBC Radio 3. Conviction. A new sequence of dramas in The Wire on Saturday nights and Drama on 3 on Sundays.
As long as I am here, you are with me.
Continuing with Bernard Shaw's St. Joan in Drama on 3.
Must not talk to me about my voices.
How do you mean voices?
I hear voices telling me what to do.
Tonight at 8:30 on BBC Radio 3.
Well, the time now is just after 1 o'clock. Time for the news with Ian Skelly.
Labour is calling for a full statement from the Prime Minister tomorrow about the role played by a friend of the Defence Secretary, Liam Fox. David Cameron has asked to see the first results of a civil service investigation into the links between Dr. Fox and Adam Werity. The Observer newspaper says it has video footage which appears to show Mr. Werity present during a private meeting between Dr. Fox and the President of Sri Lanka last year. The deputy leader of the Labour Party, Harriet Harman, described the allegations as very serious indeed. Forces of Libya's National Transitional Council say they've taken a convention centre in Sirte, where most of the remaining fighters loyal to Colonel Gaddafi are based. A military commander said the capture of the complex opened the way for his forces to take the city's centre. Hundreds of people are reported to have been killed during several days of clashes. The board of the troubled bank, Dexia, is meeting shortly in Brussels. Reports say the French and Belgian prime ministers are meeting beforehand to finalise a deal to dismantle the bank. Dexia is heavily exposed to Greek and Italian government debt and faces its second rescue in 3 years. The German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, is meeting the French President, Nicolas Sarkozy, to discuss the Eurozone crisis. They'll try to reach agreement on how to protect those banks likely to be hardest hit if Greece defaults on its debts. The Prime Minister of New Zealand, John Key, says serious questions need to be answered about why a container ship ran aground and leaked oil onto the country, one of the country's most environmentally sensitive coastlines. Mr. Key said two separate inquiries had started into the accident. In rugby, New Zealand are through to the semi-finals of the World Cup after beating Argentina 33-10 in Auckland. They'll play Australia, who beat South Africa by 11 points to 9. And the weather, it'll be a cloudy afternoon with outbreaks of rain across northern and central England and Wales. It'll be drier and brighter elsewhere and feel warm in the south. And that's the BBC News and the weather. It's 2.5 minutes past one.
With Ian Skelly. Well, now it's time to delve once more into the music of the distant past with today's early music show. Here's Catherine Bott.
Hello. In today's programme, we celebrate King Dinis, a remarkable man born in the year 1261, who ruled Portugal for 46 years, which gave him ample time to consolidate both his country's economy and its frontiers, to limit the powers of the aristocracy and to resolve conflicts in the church. His wisdom, prudence and passion for justice made his country harmonious, and he himself was hugely generous, lending large sums to the King of Castile and making a commercial treaty with King Edward II of England, which earned him this little couplet of praise in Old English. Good King Dinis doth just as he please, for a king with such gold may do as he would. You need a bit of creative thinking to make those rhymes work, but you see where I'm going. What's he doing in the early music show, though? Well, the court of Dom Dinis I was a refuge for poets and minstrels from all over the Iberian Peninsula and beyond, with a specially warm welcome for the trovadores who wrote in the Galician Portuguese language. Music and poetry were in the king's blood. After all, his Spanish grandfather was Alfonso the Wise. Music for the Virgin Mary from 13th century Spain, performed by Brigitte Lehne, a song of praise, Entre Ave Eva, built on a play on words. Eva took us away from heaven, Ave puts us back there. It's from the great collection called Las Cantigas de Santa Maria, assembled by King Alfonso X of Castile and León. Alfonso was known as El Sabio, the Wise. His reign began 9 years before his grandson, Dom Dinis of Portugal, was born, and was full of disappointments. He inherited a chaotic military setup and a ruling class of bolshy barons, and despite his much-vaunted wisdom, he managed to squander vast sums of money in vain exploits like laying claim to the title of Holy Roman Emperor, a valuable lesson in how not to do it for Dom Dinis. Alfonso was, however, blessed with a formidable intellect, which he did indeed use wisely. Despite living through an all-out attempt to rid Iberia of her Moorish conquerors, he fostered a truly ecumenical scientific and cultural climate, where astronomers flourished, where his team of Jewish, Christian and Muslim scholars translated books from Arabic into Castilian, and where musicians and poets were cherished. Alfonso had a hand in the assembly of a number of musical works, most famously the Cantigas de Santa Maria, or Songs to the Virgin Mary, one of the largest collections of monophonic songs from the Middle Ages. For these songs, Alfonso turned to the language of northwestern Spain, Galician, nowadays sometimes called Gallo-Portuguese. Castilian Spanish may have been the official language of scholarship and administration, but for poetry and songs in 13th century Spain, the only tongue was Galician. The trovadores of the time were highly prized for their compositions, which were an expressive blend of Spanish and Provençal traditions. Here's another of the Cantigas de Santa Maria.
Santa Maria leva, o ben che perdeueva, o ben che perdeueva, voglia sane. Cobro Santa Maria per sa grande umildade. Santa Maria leva, o ben che perdeueva, o ben che perdeueva, peglia sa gran lo. Cobro Santa Maria con sa gran cordura. Santa Maria leva, o ben che perdeueva, o ben che perdeueva a nostra madre antica. Cobro Santa Maria, o foi de Deus amiga.